Whatever happened to public goods, and how do we get them back?
So we say, you know, we argue and believe that public goods are those things that we decide everyone needs, that we decide democratically. We get to decide what everybody needs, like healthcare, like education, like clean air. And not only that everybody gets them, but we need everyone to have them.
That's Donald Cohen. We spend the hour with him talking about his book, The Privatization of Everything, how the plunder of public goods transformed America, and how we can fight back. And we remember Dr. Paul Farmer of Partners in Health, who died suddenly this week. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. It seems like everything is being privatized. Not just public schools. Charters, anyone? Not just college loan systems, municipal water systems, public health and fire departments, but parking meters and the right to sue in court. Privatized, privatized, privatized. When private interests take over, they strip public goods of their power to lift people up, creating instead a tool to diminish democracy, further inequality, and separate us from each other. Donald Cohen is the founder of In the Public Interest, an organization dedicated to shared prosperity and the common good. In his new book, The Privatization of Everything, which he co-wrote with Alan McCallion, he chronicles the efforts to turn our public goods into private profit centers and how we can take public power back. Well, Donald Cohen, welcome to Writer's Voice. So I was thrilled when I heard about your book, The Privatization of Everything, because it's one of my pet bugaboos, I just have to say. I mean, I grew up in the 60s when many colleges, public colleges, were free or incredibly cheap. Libraries were not limiting their hours. Healthcare was affordable. There were so many public goods, and we'll talk about what that means. There were so many public goods that were available, and all that really started to go to hell in the with Ronald Reagan and later. So I'm so glad that you've written this book, and you started with Trump and Pence declaring a so-called whole-of-government approach to tackle the COVID-19 crisis. Government is supposed to be about the public, but you call what they did an anti-public epitome. Why?
That's right. And I'm glad you introduced the topic this way, because I had the same experience when I was growing up. We counted on public goods and public services. What Trump and Pence did at the beginning of the pandemic, now nearly 2 years ago, was say, the market, not the government, should come to the rescue, right? We'll let the market solve this, which meant at the time, companies will, what did we need at the time? We needed protective equipment. We needed testing equipment. Ultimately, we needed vaccines. We needed stuff. And what they said is, well, just let the market. So companies will make that stuff and states will buy it and individuals will buy it just on the market as a commodity, which turned out to be a miserable failure. States were bidding against states for protective equipment and testing equipment. There were shortages. The private companies were taking advantage of the buyer's market and jacking up prices. So it was a complete failure. And it was a failure because, You put something in the market that's not a market thing, that's a public thing. Let me say what I mean by that. It's clearly needed everyone to get testing equipment. We clearly needed everyone to get masks. We needed hospitals and nurses and doctors, to have the equipment they need to stay safe. We needed that for everybody, not just those who could afford it, number one. And number two is the only way to make that happen is with government involvement at a deep level. That doesn't mean the government was going to manufacture the masks, but they had to coordinate the response. They had to use the power of government to make sure there were enough masks and equipment, make sure they were distributed fairly and universally and quickly. And, you know, even the Trump administration, you know, was faced with the reality that it was a failure and, you know, created Operation Warp Speed. But their first response was, this is not a public problem. This is a market issue, and let the market solve it.
You know, some of the examples you give, even on the small level, just are so outrageous. You know, Walmart's price gouging on hand sanitizer and face masks. We all remember how the different states were competing for ventilators. But even Operation Warp Speed, you know, was a different model, let's say, than what I remember when, of course, I was actually probably too young to really remember, but I do remember getting the polio vaccine. And I know that, you know, was it Jonas Salk or Sabin said, you know, when asked if they could patent that vaccine, they said, well, can you patent the sun?
Mm-hmm.
So talk about the different way in which the vaccine development happened and and what that's meant for us now in the COVID crisis.
You know, patents are a useful thing when a company invests to, you know, for R&D to develop something to be able to make their money back. So in concept, there's nothing wrong with that. But it's a contract between the public and the, you know, and the manufacturer, the inventor, whatever, so that we'll give you that exclusivity for a certain amount of time. With the COVID vaccines, Moderna was given a grant to develop and make vaccines. Pfizer was given a pre-buy agreement. I don't remember what happened with J&J, but it was one of those alternatives. So basically, we're paying for it. That's number one. We're paying for this. Number two is the science that created the vaccines. You can't separate the public from the private from that, public science from private science in that. In fact, one of the things I find most interesting is how did they sequence the DNA and the RNA so quickly to find the virus? That was because of the massive investment in public science, basic science, in the Human Genome Project in the 1990s. You know, that was during the Clinton administration that created the technology, the sequencing, it ultimately created the sequencing technology that we are, you know, we use to identify the virus, figure it out, and identify the variants so quickly. So in the case of COVID and Trump, they let the companies own the patents for a long time. They still have the intellectual property. They still control the patents. And what that really means for us, for people around the globe, is that companies don't have, other manufacturers can't make generics, can't put into production vaccines that they could easily get, you know, easily get the formulas or the science about and get vaccines so that we can get a shot in every arm across the world. Because we've given control of that that knowledge, that intellectual property, to these private companies. And, you know, I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but they're doing quite well financially.
To the tune of billions. Now, this book is about the privatization of public goods. And the classic definition of public goods, you say, actually excludes the public. So what do you mean by that? And what would be a better definition?
Sure. So let me just give the brief definition of what's in the economics textbooks. So what they say, it's a public good are those things that are non-exclusionary and non-rivalrous. Just things that you can't exclude people from having and people that if you one person using it, it doesn't mean another person can't. Just the simple example I use, streetlight. You can't stop someone from using the streetlight. The streetlight's turned on. Everyone can see it. And if one person is using the light to read their map, you know, someone else can walk up and use it too. It's non-rivalrous. So in that definition, healthcare is a private, everything else is a private good, market good. So in that definition, healthcare is a private good. Can you exclude people? Sure can. We do. And there's only so many doctors and nurses and hospitals. Now, both conditions have to be met. So we say, you know, we argue and believe that public goods are those things that we decide everyone needs, that we decide democratically. We get to decide what everybody needs, like healthcare, like education, like clean air. And not only that everybody gets them, but we need everyone to have them because we're interdependent. It's pretty clear to me through COVID that the health of all of us depends on the health of each of us. And that's true of schools. An educated nation depends on the education of each child. You know, you could kind of go down the list and look at that. So it's not just a question of making sure of rights and people should have them. It's about public goods because we all need them together and we can only accomplish them together. And that we should be able to decide what those things are, not the market.
That it's really about democracy is what you're talking about.
It's exactly right, is what we get to decide. We get to decide through democratic processes, which means, you know, we may get, we may not get, because that's how democracy works. But it's ours to choose.
Yes, I want to come back to that point. But let's stay on with some of these, you know, kind of delineating the ideology of privatization as it's been developed. You know, when I was growing up, we really saw ourselves as citizens. The word consumer, I don't think I ever heard when I was a child. Maybe customer, but not consumer. You know, I had citizenship classes all through grade school. There's a whole different concept or way of being when you think of yourself as a consumer. And you go into that in this book. What do those terms mean? Why are they so important?
They really are. So let me give you a quote from Milton Friedman, just to start this off, conservative economists. This is about education, but it's illustrative. He says, in my ideal world, government would not be responsible for providing education any more than it is for providing food and clothing. Okay. In other words, education should be a commodity that we purchase on the market, right? So that, I just want to set that in the background. Consumers, you know, we all consume, we buy things, you know, and when we consume, we really only care about our, you know, we're meeting our personal needs. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. We go to the store, we buy what we want and what we need or what have you. But citizens have a different sort of ethic and set of responsibilities and purpose. If we're buying it only for ourselves, we only care about ourselves. We don't care about who created it. We don't care about whether other people have it. Citizens, as citizens, we recognize both that we need quality services, we need good stuff, you know, but we need everyone to have good stuff. And it recognizes the fact of our interdependence when we're citizens, as well as our obligations to each other. You know, I think, again, in COVID, it's pretty clear that one person's, you know, behavior or decisions can affect another person. You know, in my view, citizenship, the values of citizenship and the ideals of citizenship is, okay, no, we're in this together. But if you're in the market, like they're doing with public school vouchers and charter schools and other things, you're really only thinking about yourself. You know, childcare is a fully privatized public good. We purchase it as a commodity. We're consumers of childcare, you know, and it's referred to as an industry, the childcare industry. Parents with kids need childcare. That's the fact of life now. So we're saying it's a commodity. You're on your own. It's incredibly expensive. But what we need as a society is to figure out how everyone can have access to it. And it's in our interest for all the kids to have access to it in terms of their educational future, our society, a whole set of things.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Donald Cohen about his book, The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America, and How We Can Fight Back. You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that because I was in a store, you know, last year at the height of the pandemic. Well, I mean, we're still at the height of the pandemic, I guess. And they just didn't have enough staff. And the store manager was complaining to me that people don't want to work because they're getting free money from the government. I didn't know because I kind of went back and then Googled the whole thing when I got back home. And I found out that that's really not the reason people were not working. They weren't working because they couldn't get childcare in the midst of a pandemic.
That's right. Or they were afraid of being, you know, getting sick because they didn't have enough equipment, or they have immunocompromised or any number of reasons. There were lots of reasons, you know, and that pandemic unemployment insurance, you know, saved the economy. So absolutely right. And let me make one other point about citizenship, which is that when you're a consumer, you know, it's axiomatic and almost silly to say that our nation is kind of divided now, right? You know, we don't need to have that discussion. But when you're just a consumer of the basic things that you need, you know, then you're not solving the problem that we all have. I think it's at the core of one of the things at the core of our division and the weakening of our democracy.
Yeah. So how did we get to this pass? I mentioned Ronald Reagan. You know, he's the guy who said, I don't know the exact quote, but basically, if the government, you know, if you hear that the government is coming, be very afraid. But it wasn't just him. In fact, Clinton was just as bad, if not worse. So talk about how this bipartisan privatization program happened in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's sort of there's some phases and forces, right? So there are true believers like Milton Friedman, you know, conservatives that have a different view of the role of government. They really believe kind of a libertarian view is that it's really our people are on their own to, you know, to find their way through life and to meet their needs. We have very little obligation to each other. They're true believers. They're also, you know, economists, you know, Nobel Prize winning economists who've developed sort of an intellectual framework, economic framework to argue that point, that in fact, it's the market that will serve us better than the government. So, you know, something called public choice theory, you know, there are economic theories. There's intellectual work here. So that was happening in the 50s and the 60s. Then corporations in the 70s, you know, started to realize, oh my God, look at all these good laws, you know, these health and safety laws that were passing because of Ralph Nader and Rachel Carson and Earth Day and, you know, the OSHA and the EPA and, you know, also National Highway Safety, you know, the Highway Safety Act and all of that, realized they needed to start get organized. So that's sort of the background. Reagan gets elected and he becomes, you know, the spokesperson for anti-government, pro-privatization, pro-market populism. He, in fact, pretty much failed to privatize very much. The Democrats were in control of Congress. It was, you know, people still, you know, there was still vestiges of people believing in public services and didn't want them, you know, taken away. So what became true then is that the conservative strategists realized that privatization, you know, they couldn't reduce federal spending as much as they wanted to, you know, downsize government at the same time. So conservative strategists realized they could use privatization as a way to direct the demand for public services that we still had to the private sector, right? So, but not be taken away stuff, you know, because that people respond against that. And they also organized the corporate sector, right, into organizations to advocate for the, you know, for privatization and contracting and these ideas. Clinton comes in an environment, in that environment. He's more conservative. He was a new Democrat, you know, with, you know, more conservative. He appoints Vice President Gore was given the assignment to do became the National Performance Review, the Gore Commission, to figure out how to re-engineer government. Not a bad thing in concept. We should always be doing that. Figure out how to do things better. But in that, you know, there's two books that came out of that of commission that have the ideas of privatization baked in two ways. One is you talked about customer. They embrace completely the language of customer. That the citizens were customers and we need to serve them well. Now, half of that idea is okay. We need to serve them well, but you're baking in the idea that they're customers. And I think that is very problematic and we're still dealing with that today, not citizens. The other is that it baked in, you know, that we should look at privatization as a real solution to things. And by the time welfare reform happened, it was the largest piece of legislation that privatized a big piece of our, that enabled privatization of a huge piece of our social safety net under TANF, under welfare reform. And, you know, big companies, defense contractors who were looking for new business lines after the Cold War started, you know, getting Lockheed Martin, Maximus, some others are now doing big pieces of our social safety net. So Clinton implemented the Reagan agenda, as it were, to privatize in deep ways.
And what happened to poverty when that happened?
Poverty increases. I mean, there's two issues there. One is welfare reform, you know, I mean, that pushed the work first of welfare reform, you know, definitely pushed people into poverty. It got some people working in low wage jobs. But I think the larger point there is when you begin to contract, the more you contract out functions of government, which has been happening at the federal government, you know, since then, you know, before then, but and since then at a higher level, what you're doing is you're taking good civil service jobs that paid middle class wages, you know, $25, $30 an hour for a job with healthcare, say, and turn it into a job that pays $10, $12, $15 an hour if we're lucky. And given that, you know, and right now, according to Paul Light, a professor at NYU, there are three times as many people who are working for, you know, providing government services who are working for a contractor than are working actually as a federal employee. So that's a huge, that's a lot of people, which has a huge impact on not just those workers, but because of the scale of it, has an impact on the labor market as a whole.
And is that why our wages have been basically flat since the 1970s?
Well, it's one of the reasons. I mean, one is the, you know, the decline of unionization, you know, of unions, which again is not an accident. You know, Reagan, of course, you know, famously, you know, launched the assault on labor unions during the PATCO strike, the air traffic controllers. And so, you know, union declines. When unions decline, you know, what do unions do? They negotiate over the spoils of productivity increases and profits so that there's, you know, it gets shared better. So what we've seen since then is the productivity increases and profit increases have all gone to the top. But contracting out plays a huge role in that, is another big factor.
You know, what's so interesting is, of course, this whole program was sold with the idea that it would save taxes, it would save money, that private business is always more efficient than the public. Give us the example. I know it's a small one, but it's so telling. Give us the example of what happened with parking meters in Chicago when that became privatized.
Oh, no, it's an important example because it illustrates a number of things. So 2008, 2009, during the worst time of the Great Recession, cities, local governments, state governments, bleeding red ink at that time. You know, these are desperate times. What happened is on a Friday, the mayor, Daley at the time, announced a proposal from a private consortium, Morgan Stanley, a sovereign wealth fund from the Middle East, and a national parking company. And the proposal was they would give the city $1.1 billion up front, you know, there are cities in need, in exchange for control, a long-term lease of the city's 36,000 parking meters for 75 years until 2083. So vote on Tuesday. They vote. They take it, you know, no scrutiny, no investigation, desperate times. They vote and did the deal. Two things are true, became, you know, after it was looked at afterwards, two things are true, one more important than the other. One is unbelievably stupid way to borrow money on your future income, you know, your future revenues, right? 75 years, who knows if we're going to be driving, right? But even if that was the only thing in a sea of bad choices, they got taken by Wall Street. They sold $1 billion too cheap, just on the numbers, if you had numbers people working on it. But that's not the important part. The important part is now, for the life of the contracts, the remaining 60-some-odd years, if the city wants to create dedicated bus lanes to increase mass transit or bike lanes or pedestrian malls because land use patterns are changing or housing patterns are changing, they have to buy the spots back at the future value of the spot. Now, the other thing, of course, that happened, of course, is parking rates went up, to like $8 an hour, I think, something like that. I don't live there. So everyone in Chicago knows this deal, hates this deal. It's horrible, but it's locked in. A deal is a deal.
So I just want to zoom in on one of the things you just said, which is that if the city wants to create better and more mass transit, it has to give the future lost profits to the companies.
Exactly, which is the most important point that you're raising. What that means is that that's why I say these deals are an assault on democracy. What are the fundamental responsibilities of a city? Land use, housing, transportation, you know, the environment, clean air, parks. Their hands are tied by this contract and prevented from being able to make decisions about that, and, you know, because they may not have what are their fundamental responsibilities? Because they may not have the money to do it. So the contract takes over our democratic rights, you know, the people we elect to do their job.
Exactly. In a time of climate change where we want more mass transit.
Exactly. And you know, there was a professor at Roosevelt University a number of years ago who did some research and wrote a piece. She interviewed transit planners and they had a plan to create a lot more bike lanes and transit lines and things, but they were blocked. They couldn't do it.
So now let's talk about another issue, water. Naomi Klein has talked about, she coined the term disaster capitalism. And you write that crises like the 2008 recession, I mean, that was an example really of it that you just gave, and the current pandemic are privatizers' dream. Water is also part of disaster capitalism because pressure on water supplies is definitely something that is part of our climate crisis. What's happening in the arena of water in the United States? Give us some examples.
Sure. And there's bad news and there's good news of water. So I'll give both sides. So, you know, our water systems need upgrading. You know, we have been funding municipal water systems around the country by not fixing them, right? So we haven't maintained them well, not universally, but, you know, but fairly so, but commonly. You know, that's what happened in Flint. They needed to upgrade their system. They didn't have the money to do it. So that's number one. Number two is, and why haven't the rates increased? Because elected officials don't want to do that. They don't want to raise taxes. They don't want to raise rates. So private companies walk in and they say, well, first, cheaper, better, faster. We know how to do things better than you. You know, we're more efficient, as you were saying earlier. And we can do this with no new taxes, right? So give us your water system and you know, privatize your water system. Again, it's these long-term deals, these long-term public-private partnerships. So a few things are true there, real simple truths. First off, things cost money. So if you need a water system, you know, and it needs to be good and provide clean water, our sewage water, you know, waste and sewage system as well, that costs money. Second is there's only one place to get that money, us. There's no other money out there. You know, you can, the easy part is borrowing the money from Wall Street or from municipal bonds, but you got to pay it back. And that's just us, right? Taxes, tolls, fees, water fees. So when a private company takes over, they say no new taxes, but they, you know, they have other expenses that they got to take care of. Profits, returns to investors, executive compensation is usually pretty high in these large companies. They are sometimes debt service because they're doing mergers and acquisitions and buying other companies. So all that money is leaving the service, but you need to pay for things and you need the water. So two things happen. One is rates go up. It's not a tax. That's technically true, but we're still paying, and wages and working conditions and other things go down because you got to cut costs somewhere. So it's pretty simple. The good news, so, you know, there's a market there. Private water companies are hovering. They see opportunity. They see and they're out there. But the good news is there's lots of places are remunicipalizing. They're insourcing them. They're taking back control. Big cities like Atlanta, it wasn't working out. I mean, for two reasons. One is it wasn't working out. It was costing more than it needed to cost. And they thought they could do it cheaper. Another is they just, you know, communities start realize it's important for them to have control over their water. That happened in Missoula, Montana. And so because we want control, meaning we want the ability to make decisions as the world changes, as climate change happens, we don't want to be locked into long-term deals that protect the profits, like the Chicago parking meters, protect the profits and the revenue of the water companies. If you look at the SE, the Securities Exchange filings, annual filings of public companies, water companies, they list a whole lot of, they're called risk factors, things that, you know, could hurt their bottom line, objectively. One of those things is conservation. So it's not, you know, they sell water. It's not in their interest to have conservation. It's in our interest to have, you know, to conserve water. And so our interests are different. And when we give control, people realize that when we give control to them, their interests can take precedence.
Donald Cohen. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. That was George Winston, Variations on the Canon. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for our free Writer's Voice podcast and newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. And find us on Facebook at Writer's Voice Radio or Twitter at Writer's Voice. And if you're listening to our podcast, give us some love on your podcast app. It really helps others to find the show. Let's get back to my conversation with Donald Cohen about his book, The Privatization of Everything. Just before the break, we were talking about how conservation and other measures to protect the public come into conflict with a profit motive when companies take over public goods. And, you know, another good example that you talk about in this book, Donald Cohen, in The Privatization of Everything, How the Plunder of Public Goods Transformed America and How We Can Fight Back. In that book, you talk about the privatization of prisons. And just as conservation is a no-no for the bottom line of the Wall Street companies that are privatizing our water, so too is the trying to tackle the issue of mass incarceration in the case of prisons, because the more prisoners, the more money they get. So talk about our prison system and just the profound failure and the human impact of the privatization of prisons.
It's prisons, by the way, and immigrant detention facilities, as well as other aspects. Because, you know, but let me start by saying one thing that's, again, sort of an obvious thing. Businesses exist to do one thing, sell things, period. That's what they do. There's nothing wrong with that in the abstract. So what do they care about? They care about how many they're selling, how many of whatever they're selling, and what the volume. And they care about how much it costs to provide, you know, to create those things or provide those services. They care about profits, what's the rate of return, and they care about market share. That's all they care about. Okay, that's their metrics. So prisons, what do they sell? Heads and beds. That's it. So again, they're taking a whole lot of money out of the service because of high executive compensation, profits, debt service for buying up other companies. So what do? They take money out of the prison, right? And there's only a very finite way. When they say efficiency, they're saying we could do it more efficiently. It means they're going to spend less money on something. So because they need to, right? Because they're taking all this money out. It's a very finite list of things they can spend less money on. The number of workers, right, in a prison, corrections officers and nurses. In fact, then they do. There was a juvenile detention facility in Mississippi, I think, that went from 1 to 12 corrections officers to inmates to 1 to 60. You know, when bad things happened, then bad things did happen. I think that facility ultimately closed. But they could pay them less, which they do, and fewer, you know, lower wages, less benefits. Bad things happen, work, you know, higher turnover, other things, you know, that has an impact on the safety of the prison. They could provide fewer, you know, or less lower quality stuff, food, say, for example, and that's happened. Private food, Ohio and Michigan privatized their food services to Aramark a bunch of years back, and food quality was so bad they found maggots in the food, and that created problems in the prison, you know. So that's the, you know, that's kind of the simple math of this. Now, the other piece of it, though, is that as in the parking meter contracts, again, private prison contracts that we looked at, and quite a few, have bed guarantees. Keep the beds filled or pay anyway. Arizona has, you know, somewhere 80%, somewhere 90%. Arizona had 100% pay anyway for the full occupancy of the prison, regardless of how many inmates there were. What does that mean? It means that if prison populations go down, which they are in Arizona because of legalization of marijuana and probably other things, we don't get to use that money that we could be saving for mental health, for job training and placement, for housing, for the other thing, you know, for the services that we want to spend money on to reintegrate folks into society, provide them health care. So, you know, they got a lock on us, right? Because they have in their contract locked in their sales volume. The other thing, of course, is, you know, they spent a good amount of money in politics and legislation and lobbying, and, you know, and every dollar they spend is about, you know, sales, heads and beds, you know, and contracts that they can get. Every dollar. There's no other reason for them to spend money, because again, that's all they do is sell things. And they do, you know, in the strong on crime period, we're a little bit past that, a little bit. You know, they were heavily involved in, you know, with ALEC and other organizations writing, you know, three strikes, you're out, and mandatory minimum sentences and things like that to, you know, to fill up our jails and prisons, because, you know, they wanted a bigger market to go after.
Exactly. ALEC being the American Legislative Exchange Council, which has written a lot of these provisions into law. Now, you talked about being locked in. Talk about broadband. You know, when I first moved full-time to where I live now, East Hampton, there was talk of municipal broadband. But now it's like some 13 years later, we still have awful service, incredibly expensive, from our broadband duopoly, Cablevision and Verizon. And there's nothing on the horizon for municipal broadband. Tell us about Tullahoma, Tennessee, and the response of the broadband giants to that kind of an example of municipal broadband.
Yeah, good question. So it's pretty clear to all of us, I think, at this point that access to the internet and broadband is as important and fundamental a piece of our infrastructure as our roads, bridges, water, and everything else. We need it. Education, healthcare, commerce, communications. It's basic. Everyone needs this, and we need everyone to have it. It's a, you know, it's now a public, it's clearly a public thing. So municipalities like in Chattanooga has fantastic broadband. I'm told it's the fastest in the country. I don't know if that's still true. And other communities were wanted to create municipal broadband to provide it cheaper, to make sure everybody had access to it, probably to create affordability schemes, you know, to be able to get control of their broadband. And a number of cities tried that. Chattanooga did, and some other cities did that. But the response of the telecommunications companies, you know, the broadband companies, was to go to state legislatures and you know, using their influence to pass laws that would preempt and prohibit cities from creating broadband, or if they already had broadband, from, you know, selling their services to a nearby city, right? So they're preemption laws is what they're referred to as in general. So they did that, you know, done that in many places around the country. There's lots of preemption laws. So the interesting thing about that story is that they did this in Colorado as well, you know, the telecoms, but they left with, you know, in what I call a pro-public loophole. You know, we weren't involved. So I don't know exactly how it all came about, but they prohibited cities from creating broadband unless the citizens voted. You know, the voters in that city or community voted to create municipal broadband, they could do it. So, and what has happened is in every place that brought it to a public vote, it won overwhelmingly. Denver, Loveland, it's a long list of cities, and they're all doing it because what people realize that everybody needs it. They realize they're not that happy with their telecom company. Everybody, you know, ticked off at their, you know, their internet company one day or another. And so they realize the private sector isn't necessarily cheaper, better, faster, and we need it all. So, you know, there is this sense that people want, you know, that when people get it, they want it.
I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and I'm talking with Donald Cohen, founder of In the Public Interest, about his book, The Privatization of Everything. Talk also about forced arbitration, basically the privatization of our legal system that strips us of our constitutional rights.
Sure. So I think most people are familiar with, if we pay attention, that, you know, when we get a new cell phone or a new broad, you know, internet company or any number of things we buy, we have to sign, you know, we have to click the, do you accept the legal terms, and their pages are tiny little print and we just accept them. Well, embedded in those consumer products are arbitration clauses, mandatory arbitration clauses that say that if you have a conflict with this company, you know, something you think they have violated, you know, a consumer law or what have you, you can't go to the courts. You have to arbitrate. You have to do it in a private system of arbitration that will determine who's right and who's wrong. So, and in those arbitrations, the arbitrators don't work for the government. They're not judges. They have different standards of evidence. It's a different system, and they're often hired by the company. Right. So right there, you kind of see the conflict of interest that happens, because an arbitrator wants to be hired again. The more they rule against a company for a consumer, the less they're going to get hired. You know, you always have to look at the incentive structures baked in. Also, arbitration is now being used, you know, massively for employment contracts. If you get hired by a company and you believe a company, you know, you have a complaint against the company, you think they're violating a law or worker safety law or what have you, part of your employment contract is to agree to resolve those conflicts through arbitration rather than through the legal system. Again, different standards of evidence, rife with conflict of interests. And so basically, it really is the privatization of our legal system. People will lose their rights to go to court.
And now the privatization of our political system. You say that privatization is primarily a political strategy. I'm going to ask you to explain that. But I would like to also say, I think privatization is primarily a corruption strategy. So talk about the link between a political strategy and rampant grift and corruption, the likes of which, you know, I don't know if it's been seen before, probably has, but on a national scale, especially now as we see the impact of Trumpism in the GOP and elsewhere.
So political strategy, a little bit what I mentioned earlier about, you know, right now, the more that companies control our basic stuff and basic public things, the more we lose what we're able to decide democratically, as I mentioned, the more money and power they have to, you know, they're using tax dollars, you know, they get big contracts, their money comes from us, they use that money to develop their power in politics, to sell more. I mean, actually to do two things, to be able to find more markets and more things to sell, but also to reduce costs, reduce taxes, reduce regulations, you know, health and safety regulations. So it's all about politics. It's all about, and, you know, the other thing, you know, I was talking about prisons a little bit ago. We call it skin in the game. Once a company, let's stay with prisons as an example. You know, they're public, you know, the big prison companies are public companies, traded on Wall Street. They have investors. They have responsibilities to their shareholders, fiduciary responsibilities to their shareholders. So the way I see it purely objectively is if there is any law, you know, state action, local action, federal action that might affect their bottom line, reduce mandatory, you know, reduce sentencing guidelines, legalization of marijuana, any number of things. A bail reform, if there's anything that could affect their bottom line, they have an obligation to their shareholders to be involved. They now have, they have skin in the game. They can't, you know, again, think about it from their perspective. They can't not be involved, right? Because that's what they want to sell things and it could hurt, and they want to make money. It could hurt their bottom line. That, you know, that's kind of the problem when we embed their interests in our interests. That's at the core of all this. In terms of corruption, the question is, how do these contracts happen? You know, because corruption is often too big a subject. You know, it's too broad. This one is there's literally someone gave somebody money, you know, and then they gave them a contract, right? I mean, that happens in some cases. I don't think that's the common problem. But I think there's a massive influence industry that is trying to influence the decisions of public officials. They're influencing them in two ways. One is they've spent 40 years influencing them about, you know, the wonders of the market and free enterprise, right? So that's kind of in the air, and the so-called efficiency of private sector. And, you know, and they're also influencing to say, listen, we understand how to deliver water. We understand how to do X, do Y. And, you know, you've got enough problems. You know, they don't have horns. They make sense. And so that's number two, right? Okay, well, it seems like they know what they're talking about. And then third, they're spending massive amounts of money, you know, in politics and lobbying. I think lobbying is the bigger, in campaigns and lobbying. I think lobbying is the bigger money. They're just in their ear all the time. But, you know, they have a massive influence. And so it's kind of all of those things that is the environment around decision makers, you know, that enables them to go after the money. And I'll say one other thing. What's clarifying for me when I realized this a few years back, outside of COVID, because it's more in COVID, the government spending $7 trillion a year, you know, from school boards to, you know, to federal government, everything, $7 trillion in total spending. Well, you're a company that, you know, $100 billion or so in corrections and, you know, a few hundred billion in water, and, you know, you add it up. If you're a company that provides one of those things, you know, it's a pot of gold. And so you're going to exercise your influence, your money and your power and your influence, you know, to get a piece of it. That's what's going on here.
Now, you know, you also make another interesting point in the book, Donald Cohen, in The Privatization of Everything, that privatization is linked to racism. And you quote Cheryl Ifill of the NAACP, where she says, "The rhetoric of hate, ignorance, cruelty, greed, and fear is a reflection of the fully privatized notion of citizenship, a feral conflict for the scraps left by oligarchs." Talk about that.
It's a great quote. I love that quote. So it's important to remember that, you know, in, let's say, public education, that in the private school choice and the privatization of public education was a segregationist, racist reaction in the 50s to Brown versus Board of Education. Families didn't want their schools, in schools with Black kids. The states, you know, the southern states, the policy response was to create school vouchers, put the schools in the market. You take your money, your public dollars, your voucher, and you can go to where you want to go and be and have your kids with who you want them to be. So take that, and then going forward to today, we're seeing that happen right now in the growth of charter schools. It's increasing segregation because it's now becoming a market thing in voucher initiatives and policies that are being passed in states across the country right now. People are, again, being they're becoming consumers, not citizens. So charter school, you know, vouchers, you're just looking around for the school you want. You don't care if anybody else gets an education. You're just looking around for the school that you want, which, of course, as a parent, that's the right thing to do. But you have to also remember that you're part of a system and part of a society. Charter schools, it's an important thing to talk about because, you know, the original idea was a good one. Create, you know, laboratories of innovation, give people some flexibility to come up with new ideas on how to teach kids in a changing world. But it's become something different. It's become, you know, basically a market model with based on competition. And so what's happened with that? So again, we're on our own. Charter schools, basically, they compete for kids, you know, for students and the money they bring with them, the public money, they're all publicly funded for students. So two things are true there. One is that no longer do you want to share, because you don't share it with your competitors, what you might learn in that charter school with the rest of the population, because you're competing with the public school, with the other schools. And so teachers that get hired to teach in charter schools, not, I don't think it's universal, but we found many examples, need to sign as a condition of employment NDAs or non-disclosure agreements that they won't share the school's, quote, trade secrets. And if they do, they could get sued. So the question, though, is what are those trade secrets? It's a private thing, right? Lesson plans, curriculum, teaching methods, the very stuff that the idea, you know, that a public education system needs to share. And then the other thing, of course, they do when they're competing is they'll do things to try to, you know, they have all sorts of schemes to screen out children they don't want or push out children they don't want that are either they're more costly, special ed kids with behavior issues or ADHD or what have you. They cost more, but also they might bring their test scores down because when parents are in the market to look for a new school for their kid, if a school's test scores are down, they might not choose that school. So again, it's the, you know, these incentives get baked in. There's a principal in New York that the New York Times found had a, quote, got to go list of his students. It was a charter school. You know, wanted to push out the bad kids. And they, you know, they figure out ways to urge them to go back to the public neighborhood school.
And it's an actual perversion of the original idea. Now, we have about 5 minutes left, and we might take even a little bit more, perhaps, to talk about what can we do about this. You have some hope for the future. Why, and what can we do?
Well, I have hope because I've seen it. You know, in the broadband example in Colorado that I gave, water municipalization, remunicipalizations, you know, the people of citizens of Baltimore put an initiative on their local ballot to prohibit privatization of water, and won, you know, and that succeeded. So I see lots of positive examples around the country where a privatization proposal is made and people say, no, we don't want it, and that the right decision is made. So that's what gives me hope. So in terms of what do we need to do, I think there's sort of two levels. There's an idea level, which I think is important. The conservatives, over the last 40 years have waged a war, an ideological propaganda war against the idea of government and the institution of government, and that there are things that we need to do together. It's been a drumbeat. Every failure of government, every corruption story, every time we get upset when we go to the DMV, although my DMV is actually quite efficient. That's the environment we're in. And they have moved those, they've also embedded those ideas that you mentioned earlier. The private sector is more efficient. Competition and the profit motive are better ways to make sure that things get better and better. Those ideas are in the air. They aren't just believed by conservatives. So what's really important is that we need our own drumbeat. This is a long game. They played the long game, and then we can move different ideas. So first, attack their ideas. Efficiency. When they say efficiency, they say they're going to do something for less. We have to ask them, what do you mean? What are you going to spend less on? Okay, if there's a difference between efficiency and just doing less and spending less money and cutting corners. So we can, again, efficiency is a fine thing. We all want to be efficient, but we have to interrogate these ideas and push back. These are not universally good. They are good depending on how you do it, because they can be bad. And competition, like I mentioned in charters, we have to push back on that. I'll often get asked by conservatives, well, what about the profit motive that has created all sorts of innovations? And yeah, there's truth in that. But the profit motive also created the opioid crisis. Again, it's not a universal good. The second part of the idea war is to lift up two things. One is that, there's government all around us, and we take it for granted. Government things that are good that are all around us. The paint on our walls used to have lead in it. People acted, a law got passed, it taken out. That's a public thing. You turn on the water comes out of the tap. So, we have to realize that there's public things all around us that we depend on to get through the day. And, I say they're both, they're ubiquitous, but invisible to us. And we need to realize that of the public things that are around us. But we also have to realize the public purpose of those things, that the roads in your community may have potholes and we need to fix them. But we need to realize that those roads are about mobility. And if we need and when people need mobility, they need to get around, and businesses need to get around, and that's a public thing that only the public can do together. Doesn't mean a private company doesn't build the road, but it's a public thing. We need to make sure. We need to make sure everyone has water, even if a private company is doing it. It's the public needs to regulate it, to make sure everybody's getting water. So we have to, articulate those values of what public things are and what public purpose is. Then more at the practical level, we need to assert control. Often what is true in governments, government agencies, is that, contracting is very hard. It's hard to do. You can have to anticipate everything that can go wrong. If you don't get the language super clear, there's ambiguity. That's where lawsuits happen. There's a lot of contract litigation in America. It's a hard thing to do. But what elected officials and staff, people, the decision makers or the contract managers often don't do is ask the hard questions and think far ahead. And I don't think they do it because they're incompetent or lazy necessarily. I think it's because it's hard and there's a lot to do. It may be that they don't know how to do it, but it also may be that it's just too much to do. So I don't want to cast it's all because they're doing a bad job. But we need to demand of them that they do that job. Ask the hard questions. The parking meters. Are we going to lose our ability to create mass transit? What's going to happen to the wages of the workers? What happens when we privatize a prison? Do we, are we able to use the resources when prison populations go down? That's the most important thing we tell folks. And when they do it, we've done this in places across the country. When people ask the hard questions before things happen, they often don't do it.
Well, your book, The Privatization of Everything, is such an important contribution to that project. Donald Cohen, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. You are the founder and executive director of In the Public Interest. We will link to that website as well as to your book. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Francesca. This was a fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Donald Cohen is founder and executive director of In the Public Interest. He's a founding board member of Power Switch Action, formerly Partnership for Working Families, and the author, along with Alan McCallion, of The Privatization of Everything, out from New Press. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Cohen's blog. We were terribly saddened this week to learn that Dr. Paul Farmer passed away suddenly. I was an admirer of him, all the more so after reading Tracy Kidder's biography of him, Mountains Beyond Mountains. We spoke to Tracy Kidder in 2010 about Paul Farmer and about Partners in Health, which he co-founded, and the work of Partners in Health in Haiti after the earthquake. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to that interview. And here's a very short poem in honor of Dr. Paul Farmer. It's by Jean Valentine. It's called Who Watches? Who Watches? For Dr. Paul Farmer by Jean Valentine. Who watches on a moon's surface hillside the soon dead children's rubber ball circle in an oval, sunstruck orbit from hand to hand? Cange, Haiti, Earth. Paul Farmer was the co-founder of Partners in Health, a community-based healthcare organization serving millions of patients in 11 countries around the world. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter @WritersVoice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.